Welcome to A Longer Table Podcast, a space where curiosity and proximity will challenge everything you thought you knew. I'm your host, Amanda Carpenter, inviting you to pull up a seat. You just might leave thinking, maybe we're not so different. Long gone are my days of shopping at Forever 21. Now that I know better, I try to do better. I try to shop ethically and avoid contributing to the world of fast fashion. And I'd rather purchase fewer high-quality pieces that will last instead of buying cheap, low-quality clothes that wear out after a few washes. This is just one reason I love Able. Able's high-quality leather, handmade jewelry, apparel, denim, and shoes aren't just investment pieces for your wardrobe. They're an investment in women around the world. Able takes their responsibility to their customers, the planet, and their social impact very seriously. So if, like me, you want insanely cute, lasting staples hanging up in your closet, and you want to support a mission that's greater than yourself, give Able a visit at ableclothing.com. Join myself and Able in moving fashion forward. Use code ALONGERTABLE15 for 15% off when you shop. Marlon, I don't know if you know this about me, but I have a saying. I always say there isn't a single person we wouldn't love if we knew their story. And that, I can't remember exactly like when I came up with it or exactly how it came to be. But the reason that's a belief that I hold in my own life is because I'm someone who I tell people all the time, I'm a professional mistake maker. I make mistakes, some that are massive with huge consequences, some that are, you know, not as consequential. But regardless, I've had times in my life where I've screwed up so bad and I've just longed for grace. I've longed for people to know that that's not who I am. I'm not the sum of this one bad thing I did. Whether that's infidelity in my marriage in the past, whether that's something entirely different. And that belief continues to be proved true. That theory I hold that there really isn't a single person we wouldn't love if we knew their story. It just continues to be proven true to me. And reading your book, Bird Uncaged, did it again. So we're going to talk about it. Thanks for being here at A Longer Table with me.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for that opening. Just to hear your saying. Thanks for that saying.
Yeah. You know, your story, there's a few places that we could start, but I think we should start with the fact that you know, in your track record, you spent 10 years in prison. You were arrested. You participated in a robbery that resulted in two murders. You were 19. And when people just know that about you, they can write all their own stories. But I could have started by saying, oh, you know, you're this advocate and the speaker, and you have a TED Talk, and you're an Aspen Civil Society fellow, and you've contributed to books by Colin Kaepernick and the New York Times bestselling author Keith Lehman and the Marshall Project editor. Anyways, I could go on and on about your accolades. And this other thing is also true. And it's interesting because depending on what we start with, people would probably come up with their own assumptions. But what you should know about our listeners and people listening right now is that A Longer Table is full of people who are like you and like me that believe that people are more than the sum of their worst mistake and that there's context to those things. So let's talk about the context to that day when you were 19 years old. For people who haven't read the book like me and don't know more of the details, how did you get there? How did you end up in a situation of a robbery, let alone one that ended in two murders?
Yeah. Things can happen so fast without individuals actually realizing the gravity of what they're getting involved in. So I was the lookout in this robbery. So I didn't have a weapon, or I don't even know the people that were harmed or killed and harmed. I wasn't in this place. But I was a part of it. I was in the neighborhood and I knew what was going to happen. And I was 19. I was the youngest of the few, several people who went. I was the youngest one. And for me, and I remember in being in court, at least speaking to my attorney and saying, listen, I really didn't, the robbery wasn't the thing I needed. It was just hanging out with my friends, and they said, just do this thing. And I was like, okay, let's go see, let's go do this thing. Me without at a 9-year-old kid thinking of the gravity of what I was getting involved with. I didn't see the people who I was hanging out with as capable of that thing. And I mean, we were obviously involved with something harmful. I mean, I knew there were weapons involved, but I grew up in a neighborhood where weapons were around all the time. So it wasn't as if they were somehow an anomaly to other people I knew or grew up with or lived mm-hmm. in my apartment building. But prior to that, and to give a little more context to that, is that prior to that, I mean, I was in school at the time. I was 3 months away from graduating from trade school at that time, and graduated from high school, honor roll student, wrote for newspapers, neighborhood newspapers as a kid, was a Jehovah's Witness, very avid Jehovah's Witness at one point in my teenage years. So the trajectory to where I went to on the surface, it doesn't lead to incarceration. Mm-hmm. But when you go deeper than the surface is where I think the book, definitely I use that book as an opportunity to go deeper than the surface. And throughout those times of me excelling in school, being a Jehovah's Witness and a nice kid, the kid that other parents wanted their kids to be with and all that sort of stuff, there was a tremendous amount of trauma that I was experiencing. You can say by myself without telling anybody about it. I was sexually assaulted at gunpoint as a kid at 14 years old. I was repeatedly robbed and jumped and beat up by people in the neighborhood or at school. But the thing that, I just glossed over it. I didn't give your audience and listeners any trigger warning or anything like that. But the sexual assault was a thing. It happened to me when I was 14. And that literally changed my entire viewpoint on like who I needed to be. Mm-hmm. And it didn't happen overnight. I mean, I still excelled, did my thing in school, but I had realized, I had thought at that point in time, my 14-year-old logic at that time was like, you know, you can still excel in school, but there's other, you can't show this smart, this brilliance or all these things overtly, because in my mind at that time, it was making me prey. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I can't be prey anymore. Cause that, you know, that for so many reasons, that incident changed my life for the negative. And then 5 years later, I'm in a sub.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that part of your story and that part of what you wrote in the book, first of all, how were you able to write in pretty significant detail? How were you able to write about that sexual assault that happened when you were 14? And I am glad you mentioned it, because there's no way that that moment in time, that traumatic event, didn't play a huge role in where you ended up 5 years later. I mean, I would agree with you. And it's sad to me that it makes sense to me. And it's also really sad that you were like, after that incident occurred, you're like, I can't be prey. Like, that type of thing can't happen to me again. I can't let this part of me show. I have to puff up my chest. I have to be someone. I have to be a different kind of Black man. And that's not fair to a 14-year-old. But okay, I skipped over the question. How were you able to write about that sexual assault? I mean, that's pretty brutal.
It was hard. The first time I ever spoke to anybody outside of my father, I write about me telling my father years later, was the only person I told. But the first time I actually told people in public really was, I like to say, that TED Talk. I remember my mother being in the audience and she knew about it, but was sort of still didn't expect me to go there because she didn't know what I was going, my TED Talk was about. But I'm bringing that in to say that the reason why I wrote about it in such detail and how I was able to do it, it's really because of the first question you asked me about, like, how did you end up where you were at? I needed people to understand at that point in time, at 14 years old, like, all the uncertainties, insecurities, the maybe I need to be more prideful, like, all these things were interacting with me in one moment. And I needed people to realize this moment was just a couple of minutes, maybe a half an hour, 45 minutes, but, like, it was so many things happening in my body, in my brain, and I didn't know what I was, how to process it. And I needed people to see, one, to have some empathy for that kid, for me to show some empathy to that person, because many years I blamed that person for being in that situation, that 14-year-old boy. So there was another reason why I denied it. But also, I think as boys, as men, we don't speak enough about sexual assault. For many reasons, right? Sometimes it's a lot of time. I think it's homophobia that we that are conditioned into many of us. for me, that was one of the reasons I thought people would think that, because it was a man, and I thought people, mm-hmm. if I told people this, they're going to think this, and maybe you wanted that. And this is what 14-year-old mind thought at that time, so I had to keep it a secret. Literally, I said that's the hardest chapter of the book to write, because I was visualizing everything again. And I kind of, in some sort of, you can say almost in a masochistic way, I mean, I was visualizing the moment as I was writing it. And I felt like the only way I could talk about that was to be very specific about it, because every moment of that situation played in my mind on a loop for decades almost. So I just wanted to, long-winded answer to your question, but I wanted people to really sit in the trauma that I was sitting in.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you did it, and it's horrifying and sad, but also a reality for so many. And when we look at a lot of who is sitting in a cell in our system right now, I wouldn't be surprised if many have similar stories throughout their childhood. So I want to go there. I want to talk about what your experience in prison for those 10 years was like. For many of us who are listening, including myself, we know what we see on TV. We know what we hear. Some of us are involved in the Equal Justice Initiative. I'm a huge fan of the work that they're doing. I'm sure you're familiar. But our view and our understanding of the incarceration system is so limited, and ignorance is bliss in that. It sadly, like I'm just admitting that what I don't know, I also always say, like, I can't unknow what I know, or I can't unsee what I see. And so I'm a little mm-hmm. nervous opening up this can of worms, because I know hearing you talk about your experience in prison for these 10 years is probably going to further my fiery passion on trying to make change and see a world where systems change. And that feels both exciting, but also really daunting and heavy. So if you're willing, tell us, describe it. What were those 10 years in prison like for you?
I always say the first 3 years were the hardest. 3 years, I was facing a life sentence when I was arrested. And so it took me 3 years before I was sentenced. So I had no bail. So for 3 years, waking up every day and not knowing if I'd ever be outside again was the most wretched thing I had to deal with. But then also, you know, there was no orientation to jail. That was my first time in that experience. I didn't have friends or family members who had that experience. So I was really like new territory. And so I had nobody to go to for advice. I had to just wing it. You know, as a 19-year-old child, and I refer to myself now as a 19-year-old child because I know 19-year-old children now. It was harrowing because it's the violence that happens. So the violence that we are all aware of, actually in the book, I don't speak a lot about the violence of it because it's a lot. And we've seen the movies and we've seen the shows and whatnot. And it's not that I wanted to deny race, but I wanted to more so focus on the emotional horrors of incarceration. Because for me, I spent a whole entire decade. I didn't have one fight in prison. Nobody ever tried to fight me. I was respected by people, not for any sort of toughness or anything like that, but because I was very similar to who I am now is who I was inside, right? In terms of being a person that write and help folks out and all that sort of stuff. But every day was harrowing because, you know, officers in the prisons felt like there was a duty to punish you above, as if incarceration itself is not the punishment. So they made it hard. And things you see about, you see about police officers in the streets beating folks up, or that, I always said, man, if they had cell phones back when I was in jail in the 2000s, in prison in the 2000s, it would be nothing in comparison, right, in terms of what I saw and witnessed. There's nothing like, I mean, being in a cage, in a closet, is one of the most abnormal experiences a person can experience. And here's a funny thing, and I'm like kind of bookended with this, is I remember the first night, the first night I'm in, and I'm in a cell, and I'm, you know, super scared, and I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, as you very cliche, when that gate closes behind me, it sounds like an earthquake just happened, right? And I couldn't, you know, you feel claustrophobic. I want to get out of here. I can't be in here. And then years later, fast forward maybe 5-6 years later, when my security level dropped to, they put me, it was called a medium security prison, where there weren't cells, but it was like more of a dormitory style. Mm-hmm. I remember saying like, geez, man, I wish I was in those cells again, because I had more privacy. And I'm just speaking about what that does to a person's mind, where they're scared out of their mind for being in this closet. Like, they claustrophobic, can't get out of it. And then after years, you adapt to it so much that you almost miss it. And that's sort of like a maladjustment. Dr. King talks about a maladjustment, not necessarily about incarceration, but, you know, that's how I'm using it. It's an experience that, you know, people say like they don't wish on their worst enemy. And I understand why folks, I say that too, because it's something that is very difficult to come out from. Like you said, I can't unsee or unhear the things I heard in there. And it takes years of therapy. I'm a writer, so I write through this sort of stuff to sort of like move on to that, but it doesn't go away. Just like people speak about their college years. You remember your college, you talk about this or the horrors or bad breakup or whatever you did, like your friends, lifelong friends. Well, my college years were my 20s, were entirely incarcerated from in prison. So I can't just forget about those things.
Yeah. I've wondered, you know, we know there's a problem. Well, there's a lot of problems in the world, but we know there's a huge problem when it comes to the transition out of incarceration. I don't have the stats off the top of my head, but like the number of people who come out of incarceration that end up back in, because there's so much trauma from not only like the crime or what happened, but then like their time in the cells for years. Like, what was that transition out like for you after 10 years? Was that, I mean, it's not just sunshine and rainbows. You walk out and you're like, yay, I'm free. I'm going to go eat a hot dog and move on with my life. Like, you probably have lasting effects from your time tell me about it.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. The last couple of years of the sentence, I've spent a lot of time like running classes and working with volunteers and preparing other people for their release who were going before me. That was part of my job, to help people prepare for their release. So many times I was preparing myself by preparing other folks. I'm telling you that because when I came home, I remember, you know, that day, and was very much mild-tempered about it. I remember wanting to not celebrate until I was actually outside the gate. Right. So, you know, you got to wait a couple hours that day before they process and people come pick you up, you know, so it's late afternoon. And people were like, well, you ain't excited about it. And I'm like, I'm still here. Like, until I want to make sure this is real, you'll let me out this place. Right. And then transitioning out, I mean, this is the thing, right? There are so many things. Technology, I was way behind, how people interact. I'd never used a computer. I never went online before that. You know, I didn't know about social media, people with Facebook, and I knew none of these things. Seeing people walk around with Bluetooth, I remember seeing people walk around the streets of Manhattan with a thing on the end. I was like, why are people talking to themselves? Like, I didn't understand what that was. So some of it's somewhat comical, but the other part of it, on a more serious note, was that there was always this fear that police was always going to come after me with. And so I would be scared to throw the trash out of it, put on my hand, something happened, like, because of that experience. And so many other folks, I mean, I've had the privilege of the blessing of having my parents, and they provided me, you know, they had a mattress. And like, you can sleep on this mattress, you don't have to pay any rent right now, you know, do what you need to do to get your life together. And so many folks who come home, the biggest obstacle they have is being able to have some place to stay. They're safe. And I had a safe place to stay. And that allowed me to leap forward in so many ways, in which I was able to start, you know, doing all the work I'm so proud of being a part of.
Yeah. That's a great segue into kind of where I want to go for the ending of our conversation. I mean, there's so much we are just scratching the surface on, but we're going to link your book so that people can, you know, I'm a big fan of like, I'll give you a teaser, but do your own homework, get the book, read it, support you, Marlon, in your work by buying the book. We'll get back to the conversation after this quick advertisement. I want to tell you about something Ian and I are using to uphold our boundaries in our home that's benefiting our marriage and ensuring that Shia doesn't always see us with our phones in hand.
It's called Aro. Aro is a solution for aligning your actions and your intentions. What I mean by that is it's easy to want a life where you spend quality time face to face with your spouse, kids, friends, every single day. But are we willing to do whatever it takes to make that happen? I know I've tried a lot of different techniques and set goals around being unplugged and detached from my phone in order to be fully present, but Aro has been the most effective by far. Here's why. Aro is one part app, one part beautiful box. The Aro app tracks the time that your phone is put away in the box, and the box, which is aesthetically pleasing, by the way, sits on our bar cart in an area of our living room that we spend the most time in. It's a visual cue to put our phones away, an invitation to be intentional. E and I will often put our phones in it, forget that they're in there. Later, when we go back to get our phone out, it tells us how much time they were in the box and allows us to actually save, or in other words, log that time as whatever we were doing. So a few recent examples from the last week for me were baking, playing trucks with Shia, park as a family, dinner prep, reading. This is so motivating for me. Aro is a true invitation to do more of the things that we all say matter to us. And I'm telling you, it will change your life. Check out Aro at goaro.com. Use code Manda to get 1 month free when you purchase an annual or 2 year membership. Now back to the show.
Okay. I am curious though, like now, I mean, it's beautiful. It's amazing. I'm a huge fan of you. I think it is cool that despite your hardships and your story and your trauma, your life's work now revolves around the pursuit of shifting our judicial system and just our world in general, but specifically the judicial system from punishment to healing, which I love because we know research shows that punitive versus rehabilitative justice. And we know that rehabilitative is so much more effective, and yet that's not the standard, the common practice. But I know you also want to see an end to prisons.
Yeah.
I am curious. It sounds radical because there are people who are going to hear that and say, well, what do you suggest instead?
Of course they are. Of course they are. I mean, our mind always goes, what's the next thing? I think people, I want to have a world without the need for prisons. I think people just think about that. Like, I just don't want prisons. Just saying that makes people think, oh, so you want people to run loose and mayhem. That's not what I'm saying. I spent a lot of time working with all type of people inside. I mean, I say working with folks. I mean, literally working, preparing with them, writing resumes, preparing parole practice, running classes. Every type of crime, sadly, people felt comfortable to tell me about what they did and have you. Everything to think of. And after everything you think of, I've been in a place where I heard the backstory. Just like you heard a little bit about my backstory just now. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't absolve the crime. I'm not telling people to absolve criminality and harm. That is the antithesis of who I am. But I also know that there are social determinants that bring people to the place where they are choosing these very horrible decisions. And then there's addictions and all those sort of things. So what I'm saying is that when I think about not a world without prisons, I understand like my neighborhood in Brooklyn or many cities and country I've been to where it's similar to like the neighborhood I grew up in Brooklyn. There are limited options. There are people who are dealing with deep traumas, just like I was dealing with deep traumas, right? And then obviously when you have people, you know, when you're using substances or misusing substances and things of that nature, all these things come for terrible concoctions. And then criminality happens. What I'm saying is that I want us as a society to spend a little bit more time and investment and resources in the social, in eradicating the social determinants. Because the social determinants are the prisons. Mm-hmm. It just so happens that we've created these big buildings to put everybody with the social determinants inside of them and then put them together to all, you know, fight each other. And then come back home to the same social determinants and say, you better not mess up again. Right, it's a hamster wheel, right? And it doesn't make anybody's neighborhood safe, right? When we are only focusing on the punishment part, we invest so much in punishment and not on the front end. Young folks, particularly, you know, when we look at young folks, I'm gonna shut up. I'm not going too long. I know, but I just want to say this.
No, you're good. You know, you're good.
When we see young folks, particularly when we think about mass shootings, I'm just going to a different place. tend to be young, but also the people who are harmed by it or being killed are young. There are things that are happening in the minds of young people, racism, all these things, misogyny, all these things are part of it that are creating the need for prisons. I'm saying that we as society in some ways complicit about it too. Me included, those of us who are forming culture, I'm not excluding myself. You know, I'll leave with your audience with this. Anytime you watch the news or you scroll and you see that horrific thing, and it's going to make you feel bad, horrible, you're going to want vengeance. And I get it. That's natural. I'm not judging them. When you get the time to ask the question of yourself, I'm not saying go do the research of the person. I wonder what happened in that person's life that would cause them to do that thing. And maybe you don't ever figure it out. But I'm saying, like, I'm just pushing people to ask those questions.
Yes. You are meant for a longer table, my friend. This is like the mission, the vision of this podcast, of these conversations, is just to give people a taste of, on a variety of different topics, what would it look like for you to invite curiosity and humility into your life, because it will challenge everything you thought you knew. So I love that.
And you'll see yourself in a little bit of it. And that's yep. Because people who read my book who are nowhere near where I've lived growing up, demographic, I've said, wow, I've seen this. I remember this touched me in a way that was not because of your story, but it was so close to my story in various ways. So
yeah,
when you're able to be curious, you can see more of yourself and others.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you and I, looking at us, we couldn't be more different. I'm a white woman, you're a black man, and our stories aren't the same, but man, we've got a lot in common. Bird Uncaged, we're going to link it. This book is incredible. Marlon, how else can we support your work, follow along? And I guess it's one more question, if you don't mind. What can we do? Do we need to be volunteers and find out if our local jail needs volunteers, or should we just be investing in our local public schools? What is the answer for how can an average, ordinary person like me and a lot of our listeners do something to help be more proactive, like you were saying, to prevent this, the stories like yours, where kids endure trauma and make bad choices and hang out with the wrong crowd and then end up in situations that they said, how the heck did I get here?
Yeah, I think here's a couple of things. Yes, I think people should look in see the situation in the local jails, prisons. If you can, volunteer, offer some sort of support to them, to programs that are like landing boards for people coming home. If you can share resources, that's another way. Be in schools. Find ways to volunteer in your local school. I don't think people realize you can just create a relationship with administration of school. And if you have some particular skill, talent, or anything, go give energy to these kids, knowing that the community is there for them, even as a young age. But there's another thing that somebody can just do without leaving their house. And someone just made me think about it. In this era of social media, just like I said, when you're scrolling and you see that thing or whatever, ask those questions on the page. Create a dialogue on social media that way. I think that's one way to just, we want to have a groundswell eventually of people being able to ask these different questions, because then we lead to different solutions. And that's what we want. I want a solution that does not lead to prison. That's all I'm asking for. And I think everyone wants a solution when they live in a world where they don't have to have a need for prisons. Mm-hmm. We just don't want to say like that because we're conditioned. But here's the thing, people can get in touch with me. So I'm writing a screenplay adaptation of this book. So there's been some interest. That's why, before we came on, I said, I love Los Angeles. I've been out there a lot. So there's some interest in it. If people can do this, this is me just sort of like a crowd using the opportunity with your audience.
Yeah.
Tweet after you read the book. Hopefully I'm not saying we'll read it, skip, whatever. Tweet. We would love to see this in the movie form. I would love to see that hashtag Bird in Cage. Because you know anything about that world, obviously, people, what drives things is mass support. So,
yeah.
My Instagram and Twitter is _MarlonPeterson. Very simple.
Wonderful. We'll be tagging you in our posts on A Longer Table Podcast Instagram as well. But yes, I compared your book in the best way to Just Mercy. Different stories, but it did become a movie.
Yeah.
I was there opening day. It is my favorite book, turned one of my favorite movies. Also, I'm a big Michael B. Jordan fan. So, you know. Yeah, Marlon. Hey, that would be... You know, I would also become his biggest fan if that, you know, he did more movies like that with so much meaning. So, yeah, thank you for sharing your story and using your life and the hardest parts of your stories to make a difference in the lives of so many. It matters. Thank you for being at our table. Thank you for challenging us today. We adore you. So thanks for being here.
Thank you. Stories are the essential.